Our objective needs to be that we have a regime in Afghanistan that can maintain some semblance of security.
Annual military exercises are underway in South Korea. It's Tuesday, August 22nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, President Trump to announce new strategy for Afghanistan, learning Mandarin in the United States, investigating Pacific U.S. naval collisions, finding a youth reset button, a warming Arctic. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The forces of the United States, South Korea, and other allies began computer-simulated annual military exercises Monday, a decision North Korea denounced Sunday as an explicit expression of hostility and warned, quote, no one can guarantee that the exercise won't evolve into actual fighting. Pyongyang has viewed such exercises as a prelude to invasion.
방어적 성격의 연례적인 훈련이며
South Korean President Moon Jae-in said there's no intent to heighten military tension on the Korean Peninsula. He described them as regular and defensive in nature. He called on the North not to engage in provocations that could worsen tensions. The exercises, dubbed Ulchi Freedom Guardian, are expected to last 10 days. They're designed to prepare for conflict with the North, which has detonated 5 nuclear devices and tested intercontinental ballistic missiles. Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Washington-based Center for the National Interest, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the exercises amount to routine military preparedness.
All these countries, the United States, South Korea, various allies that are joining in, Canadians, for example, always do these type of training exercise. What it actually ultimately does is test something called command and control. In other words, when you have armies, navies, air forces all working together, all the various computer systems and whatnot all have to talk in order to execute commands. And that's basically what this does. This is a very non-provocative sort of exercise. So for the North Koreans to throw out their usual bluster with something like this, I think is way over the top. And I think we have to keep in mind, the North Koreans do military exercises all the time, and we don't freak out. We look at them as a normal thing. This is what militaries do. So there's nothing to hyperventilate about from Pyongyang's perspective, but of course they're going to do it anyway for propaganda purposes.
Well, ordinary exercises, but in an extraordinary period, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a very heightened sort of tensions on the Korean Peninsula sort of time. I think it's one of those things where everybody sort of has to take a little bit of a deep breath and act calm and act rationally. I think if you look at the U.S. side, along with its South Korean, Japanese, and other allies, we've been very transparent on what we're doing. These exercises are nothing provocative. That the North Koreans have a very good idea of what we're doing. We've done this many, many times before. I think the North Koreans were secretly hoping that we would use this as some sort of bargaining chip, maybe if they can get some leverage. And I think what you're actually seeing is they're just more upset that we didn't cancel them and sort of offer them a bargaining chip.
China has said that talks are very important, and one way that the two sides could back off is that the North would stop its testing of missiles and nuclear devices. At the same time, the U.S. South Korea would back off their training exercises.
On the surface, it doesn't sound like a bad idea. You know, the United States and South Korea give something, and at the same time, the North Koreans give something. Here's the challenge. Military exercises are a very normal sort of thing. And yes, the United States could back off on those. And actually, we have done that in the past to try and give certain bargaining chips and sweeteners to the North Koreans. But the thing that I worry about, it feels like we're rationalizing their behavior. You know, we're saying, oh, don't do missile tests. We'll give you something to stop. We've done this in the past before. You know, if you even go back to the 1990s, you know, we gave them oil. We tried to give them light water reactors to stop building nuclear weapons. They cheated and did it anyway. So my feeling on this is, look, the North Koreans, I think, are the ones that have to be the ones to come to the bargaining table and offer something to the international community before we take a step.
Harry Kazianis said such military exercises do not necessarily invite North Korea to respond with a missile or nuclear test. He said they have to conduct tests anyway to improve their systems. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. U.S. and South Korea seem to scale back war games. Anger simmers in Philippines over Duterte's drug war. China's Great Wall confirms interest in Fiat Chrysler. Vietnam's president calls for tougher internet controls. China to relaunch one of the world's fastest bullet trains. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more, they're always found on Facebook at VOA Asia and also our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. After a months-long review of U.S. strategy, President Donald Trump is about to address the American people from Fort Myer, Virginia, near Washington, on the way forward in Afghanistan, 16 years after the United States intervened to defeat the Taliban regime following the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. Reports indicate the possibility of Afghanistan's mineral wealth being used to help pay for the conflict and reconstruction efforts. Senator Ben Cardin, the ranking Democratic member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, appearing on the Fox News Sunday program, was asked what U.S. policy in Afghanistan should be.
We have invested a great deal in Afghanistan. Our objective needs to be that we have a regime in Afghanistan that can maintain some semblance of security so that we don't see growing terrorist organizations again within Afghanistan. That's our objective. Should we use private contract troops? Absolutely not. There's no accountability there. That's not the purpose for private contractors. No, we should not do that. Should we put more military in? Again, this is not the U.S. fight. I don't believe putting more American soldiers in Afghanistan is the answer.
The White House said in a statement the president will provide an update on the path forward for America's engagement in Afghanistan and South Asia. That's important, said Wilson Center Deputy Asia Program Deputy Director and South Asia Senior Associate Michael Kugelman, who tells VOA U.S. policy toward Pakistan is also important.
And that's wise, as I say, because it's very hard to consider ways forward in Afghanistan without looking at the very connected case of Pakistan, which is a bordering country of Afghanistan and also happens to play a key role in the war in Afghanistan because, among other things, leaders of the Taliban insurgency have used Pakistan as a sanctuary.
Kugelman overall thinks the president won't announce too many surprises.
My own gut feeling is that even after a very long, really an 8-month strategy review period, I imagine that the president will come out with a policy that will be very similar to what has been used by the Obama administration, which entails maintaining a modest U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, though I imagine that could entail sending several thousand more troops to enhance the current. Bottom line, I really do think that his policy will not have many surprises. I do not think it will have any outside-the-box thinking. Ironically enough, it's going to look a lot like what the Obama administration had in effect, with some changes around the edges.
The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, praised the Afghan Army's new Special Operations Corps, saying, "We are all with you and we will stay with you."
Well, absolutely. And I think this is one of the major arguments for why the U.S. should maintain a military presence in Afghanistan. And that's because there has been significant progress with training the Afghan security forces, and particularly the special forces, who are very well trained, they're very efficient, they don't suffer from the same morale problems that the broader security forces do. And the U.S. has really worried that these special forces, who number only about 12,000, are getting exhausted and overextended because they're being used in contexts that they shouldn't be used because the rest of the security forces don't do a good job. So I think that one could argue that by maintaining the U.S. training mission and perhaps expanding it by including several thousand more U.S. troops, you could then be in a position to increase the number of Afghan special forces, which would be a boon, certainly on the battlefield, but across the board it would be a good thing for Afghan security forces.
Michael Kugelman, however, describes the security situation as alarming, given that the Afghan government controls less than two-thirds of the country, while the Taliban holds more territory than at any time since 2001. Kugelman said expectations in Afghanistan should remain low. He said whatever the U.S. policy, a military solution is unlikely, and given its battlefield successes, the Taliban will probably not be enticed to engage in talks to reach a political solution. Happening now in Asia, 10 American sailors are reported missing, 5 others injured, after the U.S. Navy destroyer USS John S. McCain collided with a merchant ship east of Singapore near the busy Strait of Malacca. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us, as always, on VOA Asia. The number of U.S. students learning Mandarin is growing rapidly and may reach 1 million by the year 2020. The U.S.-China Strong Foundation is running the 1 million campaign targeting K-12 students that makes major efforts to make the ambitious goal a reality. VOA Mandarin reporter Adriana Chang talked with Eugene Huang, acting CEO of the foundation.
The foundation was established jointly by the U.S. government as well as the Chinese government, and was spun out of the U.S. government about 5 years ago to focus and promote Mandarin language instruction in the United States. There's a recognition that the U.S.-China relationship is one of the most important relationships in the world, and to understand how to invest in the relationship, both countries realize that there is an understanding that we need to invest in the future of students, and there's no better way to invest in the future of students than encourage the instruction of and learning of Mandarin language in the United States. The original initiative was set up as a goal. The goal was to get 100,000 U.S. students to do study abroad in China. And when we accomplished the goal, both the president of the time of the U.S., President Obama, as well as Chinese President Xi Jinping, said, we've been able to exceed that goal. Why don't we set up an even more ambitious goal? And so in collaboration with the foundation, we set the ambitious goal of getting 1 million U.S. students to learn Mandarin by 2020. In recent research conducted by the College Board, the Asia Society indicates that right now there are about 400,000 U.S. students who are currently studying Mandarin. So we are well on our way to meeting the goal, but we still have a long way to go.
Are those non-Chinese American students your major target?
They are our major target. And so what we're doing is that we're working with school systems around the country. We're working with technology leaders and platforms to really provide resources that can be used both in the classroom and outside the classroom to help individuals find ways to learn Chinese both in school as well as on their own.
So I also understand that you're creating this homegrown core of teachers, meaning some of the teachers may not be even Chinese.
There's a strong belief that the foundation, that it doesn't necessarily need to be somebody who looks ethnically Chinese to be a teacher. And, you know, if you look at some of the most successful teachers of Mandarin language in the United States today, some of those teachers look like somebody who you would think of as being sort of reflective of the diversity of America. So you see individuals who are white, who are Hispanic, who are ethnically Asian, and others, all who are very, very committed to teaching Chinese.
We also spoke with Eli Zimmerman, who happens to be a former VOA Asia intern who studied Mandarin for about 3 years in high school.
Freshman year of high school, I started learning Chinese. They offered a whole bunch of different languages. In the end, I ended up choosing Chinese because I wasn't sure if I wanted to do something like communications or business, which is what I was leaning towards at the time. I figured that because China was sort of growing in that retrospect, in that aspect, and that I had seen a lot of people or heard a lot of people talk about Chinese as being sort of like the language to know, I figured that having a talent or having a skill like that, that not a whole lot of other people had, would sort of make me stand out.
Was it hard?
Oh, yes. It was very hard. I think that the hardest part of Chinese is that it really is unlike any other language that I've ever had to learn before. I think that it was something that I hadn't really ever experienced before, and I had to take a new approach to learning it. But just because it was a challenge, I wouldn't say that it was a bad challenge.
So would you prefer a teacher who looks like you but speaks fluent Chinese or a Chinese Chinese to teach you?
Hands down, I would rather learn from someone who is actually from China as opposed to someone from America. I think that there's certain nuances and certain unspoken parts of a language that you wouldn't really get unless you were learning from someone who, you know, grew up where it was the main language.
Eli Zimmerman speaking with VOA Mandarin reporter Adriana Zhang. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The United States and South Korea began their annual military exercises Monday. Peace activists protest against them at the U.S. Embassy and presidential offices in Seoul. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the U.S. Navy has ordered an immediate worldwide operational pause after a guided missile destroyer collided with a merchant ship Monday east of Singapore, the second such collision in as many months. 10 American sailors are reported missing, 5 injured, with the USS John S. McCain sustaining significant damage as a result of the incident near the Strait of Malacca, according to a statement from the U.S. 7th Fleet. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson, has ordered an immediate operational pause for all U.S. fleets, along with a broader investigation in the root causes of what he described as a series of incidents in the Pacific Theater. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told reporters the probe will be wide.
The Chief of Naval Operations' broader inquiry will look at all related accidents, incidents at sea, that sort of thing. He is going to look at all factors, not just the immediate ones, which will fall rightly under the fleet commander's investigation of what happened to his ship. But this is a broader look at what is happening.
The commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, Admiral Scott Swift, is en route to Singapore to take charge of operations involving the damaged USS McCain. Officials said the collision punctured a hole in the ship's hull below the waterline, causing several areas to flood, including a sleeping compartment for sailors, as well as some of the ship's communications rooms. The U.S. Navy says it is continuing search and rescue operations with the help of local authorities, including the Malaysian and Singaporean navies. The collision is the second involving a ship from the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet in the Pacific in 2 months. Developing at this hour in Asia, Taiwanese Premier Lin Chuan says the government will minimize the probability of another power blackout, but can't guarantee there will be no reoccurrence. Human error plunged tens of thousands into darkness last week amid sweltering temperatures. This and other of the day's stories may be seen on VOA 60 and visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, as legend has it, Spanish explorer Juan Ponce de Leon was searching for the mythical Fountain of Youth when he discovered Florida instead. Well, it turns out he didn't have to look that far because the Fountain of Youth may be located right between your eyes. Stem cells in an area of the brain called the hypothalamus may literally be setting the body's clock. VOA's Kevin Enix is looking for his reset button. As he tells us, researchers from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York may have found a way to turn back that clock, at least in mice.
Scientists have known for some time that the region of the brain called the hypothalamus controls critical functions like growth, reproduction, and metabolism. New York researchers have discovered that hypothalamus stem cells also play a direct role in how the body ages.
Aging speed is controlled, can be controlled by a particular place in the body, which is the hypothalamus. And it can be controlled by a particular type of cells, which are hypothalamus stem cells. I think these findings are quite interesting, potentially remarkable.
Basically, when the hypothalamus starts aging, so does the body.
So when hypothalamic function is declined, particularly the loss of this hypothalamic stem cells, and this protection against the aging development is lost, so it eventually lead to aging.
Knowing that, the researchers began trying to invigorate the hypothalamus of lab mice with stem cells.
When we injected the hypothalamus stem cells, which were derived from young mice, we injected them to the middle-aged mice, and there was an effect to slow down aging. So the mouse aged slowly, and they also have they had the increased lifespan, which is longevity.
The next step, of course, is to see if the anti-aging effects also work in humans.
If we can translate what we have seen in animals to humans, I think a human, they can function better during later ages, later stage of aging.
More importantly for these researchers, the discovery could also help doctors diagnose and treat any number of age-related health issues. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, while Ponce de Leon was in Florida, each summer climatologists and ship captains, as well as Inuits living in the Arctic, have been reporting that the ice there is getting smaller and smaller. VOA's George Pudich reports this might be good for Arctic tourism and fishing, but it's very bad for polar bears.
A lonely polar bear is stranded on a floating piece of Arctic ice, surrounded by patches of blue water. Years ago, even in summer, this area would have been covered with thick ice and inaccessible by sea. Now, the 13,000-ton Finnish icebreaker Nordica plows through with no resistance. Its ice navigator, hired to guide the ship through dangerous waters, says ice here used to be many meters thick.
Last year, as an example, this area that we're in now and is completely covered by ice melted out so completely that even McClintock Strait was free of ice, a very rare occurrence.
Satellite observations since 1979 show Arctic ice coverage dropping by an average of about 88,000 square kilometers a year, equal to the size of Serbia. Scientists say the decline is irreversible, even if countries which signed the 2015 Paris Climate Accord follow through on their promise to keep global warming under 2 degrees Celsius.
The Arctic is melting back at a rate of about 2.5% per decade in May, and about 10.4% per decade in August.
Some see certain benefits. The once permanently frozen Northwest Passage from the Northern Atlantic to the Northern Pacific is now open in summer, allowing cruise ships, fishing trawlers, and merchant vessels that bring goods to local communities to sail through. But the negative consequences may be long-lasting.
You can have cruise ship tourism to see polar bears that won't be there in 20 or 50 years.
Local inhabitants say even their children notice changes and have mixed feelings about them.
The ice in our bay, when it went, like they noticed it really quickly. They kept saying, oh, there's boats coming out, there's boats anchored. And my son was excited about it, but my daughter said, oh, there goes our trail.
Scientists say if the trend continues, most Inuit children will soon have regular ice-free summers and perhaps ice-free winters as well. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and we'd like to let you know that there are a lot of different ways that you can hear us. Try out iTunes and SoundCloud if you'd like to download our program as a podcast, and you can take VOA Asia wherever you go. We also like to say a special hello to everybody who's listening in Myanmar via Facebook. VOA Burmese is where everybody there catches our program. We thank you so much for joining us today, and we hope to have you back again. You can also find us streaming online at voanews.com and, of course, VOA Asia Facebook, a great place to go each and every day for wonderful features and stories, and hear our program. You can contact us by sending us a message there, too. We hope you do. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team as well. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a great day.